June 30th, 2015 should have been the beginning of the end for Spotify. Before that, it was playing on easy mode. Its biggest competitors were Pandora, which mistakenly put all its eggs in the radio basket, and a niche service called Deezer, which attracted just 14,000 subscribers in its first 3 months. This was the era of cheap capital, blind optimism, and endless patience for money-shredding startups disguised as disruptive innovators. At its peak, nearly 125 startups reached billion-dollar valuations in 2015 alone. Then the music stopped, so to speak. With the launch of Apple Music in June of that year, the writing was on the wall. Apple had every advantage Spotify was missing. It could pre-install Apple Music on not one but all of the top 7 best-selling smartphones. It could bombard 2.2 billion devices with notifications, advertise in its 500 physical stores, bypass its own 30% App Store commission, and capitalize on its long-standing music industry connections. Today, Spotify's 3 biggest competitors are the 2nd, 4th, and 11th most profitable companies in the world. And yet, the end never came. Quite the opposite. Not only is Spotify still the largest music streaming service with 239 million paid subscribers, it's also twice the size of Apple Music. Looking at this graph, it's not even clear that the much-feared entrance of Apple, YouTube, and Amazon made a difference. Spotify just continues to grow and grow and grow. That is, in every way but one. And it's kind of a big one. While its revenue keeps on climbing, its profit, conspicuously, has not. In fact, not one of its now 18 years in business has been profitable. In fairness, this isn't really Spotify's fault. When it was founded in 2006, the music industry was in rapid decline. File-sharing applications like Napster and LimeWire had created a culture of piracy, devaluing music in the process. Apple, hoping to reverse this trend, introduced 99-cent songs on iTunes. It hoped that by making it so easy and so cheap to pay for music, consumers would prefer it to the hassle of piracy. As you can see, these digital sales helped offset some of this loss, but not nearly enough. Then Spotify took this simple yet revolutionary concept one step further. $10 a month for unlimited streams of every song ever made. It was simply too good a deal to resist. Soon, the industry began growing again, and by 2021, it had fully recovered from its 20-year decline, even surpassing its 1999 peak, all thanks to streaming. Now, Spotify is often criticized for underpaying artists. The bottom 85%, for example, receive only about 5% of all payouts. But, like most creative industries, music has always been winner-take-all. And artists as a whole earn a whole lot more today than 10 years ago, about twice as much if this chart is any indication. Sure, it's hard to argue that the ability to play any song at any time for no additional cost hasn't contributed to the commodification of music. But again, it all goes back to demand. The threat of piracy gives consumers an unusual degree of control over the music industry. And we use that control to keep prices low and access unlimited. Whereas one household might subscribe to some combination of Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, Paramount Plus, and HBO, we expect nothing less than every song ever made from a single music service. These companies, therefore, can't really compete on the thing you and I care about most, content. And if you and I are tough to please, record labels are downright demanding. Just three control roughly 70% of the entire industry. Universal alone represents all these artists. Spotify, therefore, virtually has to pay these labels whatever they ask for, 63 cents to be precise for every dollar it collects. It's caught, in other words, between two behemoths, platforms like Apple on one side and labels on the other. In this low-margin business, there's only room for so many middlemen, and Spotify is simply one too many. Worse, Spotify is the public face of this broken and unfair industry that it fails to make money from. It takes all of the blame and none of the profit. Now, you might be wondering why Spotify doesn't raise its prices. If music is underpriced, why not pull one of the few levers in its control? After all, even one more dollar each month, multiplied by 239 million users, is a huge sum of money. But this is not nearly the solution it appears to be. The devil lies in the details, the complex and varied contracts it signs with record labels. The basic problem is that Spotify doesn't pay per stream. That would allow one determined user to bankrupt the company. But it also doesn't pay per user. Labels would never sign away so much control. Instead, it typically pays a percentage of revenue, meaning the more it earns, the more it owes. Think about just how incredibly terrible this is for Spotify. Any price increase would necessarily annoy customers more than it would benefit the company. $1 of customer frustration for every 37 additional cents earned. This is the critical difference between Netflix, which is profitable, and Spotify, which isn't. The former pays a fixed cost to produce an original movie. Anyone who signs up after it earns this back is pure profit. Whereas Spotify's costs are variable. Even though it's in the software business, it's still constrained by the laws of physics. More ones and zeros are free for Netflix to produce, but not for Spotify, as if it has to physically manufacture more CDs or cassettes. It can't even set its own prices without worrying about jeopardizing its all-important relationship with labels. To be clear, it can, has, and probably will raise prices again. But doing so would only allow it to, at best, eke out a small, consistent profit. And that's simply not good enough for a publicly traded company. And certainly not for one in the tech industry that investors expect to take over the world. So, what do you do when you're stuck in an unprofitable industry? You try to escape. You do what Apple and Google and Amazon do, subsidize music with other more lucrative products. Spotify needs to find its iPhone. Or, to be more realistic, something that isn't giving away the entire universe of music for pennies on the dollar. At first, it thought that something might be podcasts. And not without reason. Over the last 10 years, podcasts have grown from a tech industry niche to a mainstream source of entertainment on par with radio. 183 million Americans, or 64% of the population age 12 and up, have now listened to one. 42% listen at least once a month, and 31% once a week. The average listener consumes over 9 hours of podcasts each week. That's a huge opportunity, especially given our strong tolerance of podcast advertising over YouTube, TV, or radio. So, Spotify went all in. It started by buying Anchor, Gimlet, Parcast, Megaphone, Pods, and The Ringer for a combined $877 million. It then signed exclusive deals with the Obamas, Joe Rogan, J.J. Abrams, Dax Shepard, Meghan Markle, Prince Harry, and Kim Kardashian. Investors saw this as Spotify's House of Cards moment, a pivotal turning point that would finally lead it to profitability. Its stock price soared to new highs. But the turning point never came. The Obamas left for Audible, Meghan Markle and Prince Harry's podcast was cancelled, and Joe Rogan is no longer exclusive. 2 years later, it began to seem as though the company may have simply thrown away $1 billion for nothing. The problem wasn't with the concept of exclusives, which can be an effective way of getting users to try out a new platform. But when you don't give them a reason to stay, it just feels like they're being held hostage, and they'll escape the first chance they get. In other words, there's no real reason to listen on Spotify. The interface wasn't any better, nor were there any unique features. And it may have learned from this mistake and slowly adjusted its strategy, except that it chose to do this in the most risky way possible, with $100 million celebrity deals. So, with podcasts far from the silver bullet the company was hoping for, Spotify moved on to its next idea, audiobooks, paying $125 million for a publisher called Findaway. Like podcasts not so long ago, the audiobook world is small but ripe with potential. While only 23% of Americans have listened to one in the past year, that's twice as many as 10 years ago. Today, Spotify offers 15 hours of free audiobooks each month to premium subscribers. After that, users can pay $12.99 in the US for 10 additional hours. Now, the company has tried very hard to sell all this, music, podcasts, and now audiobooks, as different phases of a single, coherent, and ambitious grand strategy to become the destination for all things audio. The unspoken assumption is that users prefer the simplicity and convenience of using one app for everything. That, like the Apple Watch and iPhone, each of these three mediums are better together, what someone wearing an expensive suit might call synergy. But what if this is just wishful thinking, a business solution to a consumer problem that doesn't exist? What if, despite their technical similarity as longer or shorter audio files, most people think of music, podcasts, and audiobooks as entirely different mediums, serving different purposes? This creates a fundamental tension between Spotify on one side, desperate to diversify, and users on the other, who were perfectly content with all the world's music alone. Don't assume, however, that just because users may not be happy, the company is. Ironically, this may not be a clear-cut case of greedy shareholders versus angry customers. Don't underestimate Spotify. It's perfectly capable of losing billions of dollars and annoying its customers at the same time. It's not clear that the company has had a net positive effect on podcasts, audiobooks, or their listeners. A few years ago, it inspired a massive bubble around podcasts. Shortly after Spotify's acquisitions, Amazon and SiriusXM went on shopping sprees of their own. But when the bubble popped, fans watched in dismay as their favorite shows were canceled. And yet, it's also not clear that this is good for Spotify either. When Neil Young protested its relationship with Joe Rogan, for instance, Spotify's existing business, music, became a liability, not an asset. Likewise, it's now betting that it can capitalize on audiobooks by introducing its 618 million monthly active users to the medium. Yet, it may do just the opposite, squander its potential. The question is, how annoyed will listeners be when they get stopped 15 hours into a 16, 18, or 20-hour book? And will they then pay the extra fee, or will they simply wait another month for free? In the latter case, Spotify has created a new expense without receiving any additional revenue, digging its financial hole even deeper. Eventually, the company will surely start charging for those first 15 hours of listening. But by then, will it have done to audiobooks what it did to music, commodifying and thereby reducing their perceived value until we're unwilling to pay? Think about it this way. Are you more or less likely to see an audiobook as a valuable item worth paying for when it's squeezed between two songs you listen to for free? Rather than pursuing a single coherent strategy, it sure seems like Spotify is just jumping from one unprofitable industry to the next, repeating the same mistakes over and over and over again. First, it blindly dumps millions of dollars into the next big thing, podcasts, then audiobooks, and soon online courses. This is critical to distracting investors, who reward this short-term behavior. As long as there's some breakthrough right around the corner, they won't realize that Spotify is stuck in an unprofitable position within a low-margin industry and that it's at a disadvantage in each new one it enters. And while the enormous checks it writes may seem entirely wasteful, the truth is that they serve a valuable function, again, distracting investors. Second, by virtue of its sheer size alone, not to mention the billions it spends on exclusives, it attracts millions of new listeners to its latest obsession. It then justifies this new venture using these cherry-picked, impressive-sounding numbers, sustaining the faith of its investors just long enough that it can, 3. Move on to the next big thing. An act of desperation, it invariably pitches as the next phase in its grand strategy. Notice how at no point in this process does Spotify actually earn more money. Even when it does create new audiences, other companies always seem to capture this value. Podcasts gain new listeners, who they take off-platform. Startups cash in on the hype, and publishers consolidate their control, leaving Spotify right back where it started, minus several hundred million dollars, of course. Spotify's real core competency, it seems, is generating large amounts of money for other people. Oh, and along the way, the company annoys its paying customers by bombarding them with new features they didn't ask for. At this point, Spotify has tried nearly everything. At first, it was merch, then concert tickets, paid discovery for artists, building an alternative to record labels, an $89 in-car speaker, short-form video, live audio, music production tools, an artist-for-hire service, original videos, podcasts, audiobooks, and now courses. After nearly two decades, it may finally be running out of useful distractions. It may soon be forced to reckon with the simple fact that it will likely never be as profitable as its investors imagine. Or it may just invent some new distraction, starting the cycle all over again. If only Spotify had listened to the advice of co-founder of Netflix, Reed Hastings, in his book No Rules, Rules, which you can learn more about with today's sponsor, Imprint. In it, for instance, I learned several secrets to the company's success. 1. The Netflix innovation cycle, which empowers individual employees to experiment with new ideas, even without their boss's approval. And 2. Offering generous severance packages to underperforming employees, allowing the company to maintain a high talent density. Imprint takes some of the best, most influential books, like Flow and Getting Things Done, and distills them down to their most essential lessons, which it presents as animated interactive guides. Personally, I found David Allen's Getting Things Done genuinely transformational. I've now been using a daily to-do list system to manage both my work and personal life for years. I schedule what I need to get done a week in advance and wake up each morning knowing exactly what to do and when. That said, I feel sort of bad recommending a 400-page, 10-hour book about time management to my friends who don't have any free time. Ironically, those who need these books the most have the least time to read them. And frankly, I find many self-help books to be fairly repetitive. That, to me, is the value of Imprint. It cuts through this repetition and allows anyone, no matter how busy, to learn this knowledge. And because most of its lessons only take a few minutes to complete, Imprint is a great alternative to mindless social media scrolling, making you feel more productive and less guilty about using your phone. In addition to daily activities like quizzes and streaks, Imprint even has courses on topics like philosophy and the science of happiness. The best part is that you can try Imprint completely free for 7 days with my link on screen or in the description below. Plus, you'll also get 20% off your subscription. Get started now and download the app today.